We are now at the beginning of the year 2009. We are 30 years on from the Iranian Revolution of 1979, one of the most dramatic and important events of the last century. We are one day after the inauguration of a new American president, an Afro-American president whose middle name is Hussein. We are just a few days after the end of a three-week war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And it seems to me one doesn't need to be a prophet to know that this year, 2009, may well turn out to be a very fateful year in the history of the Middle East, of Israel, of the Arab world, of the Jewish people, of America, Europe, and indeed the rest of mankind. We are obviously at a very important crossroads. And one somewhat neglected aspect of that is tonight's subject, the Sunni-Shia conflict, something which in recent years has become of increasing concern in the Arab world and Arab political discourse. We talk of the Shia resurgence, the Shia threat, the Shiite crescent has become increasingly notable. As you know, the largest, and in fact the only fully Shiite state in the Middle East today is Iran. And Iran is in all of our minds. But in recent times, something unprecedented also happened, which others will elaborate on. For the first time, an Arab country, namely Iraq, has also come increasingly under some form of Shiite control. That too is a matter of considerable significance. I do not intend to go into, perhaps Professor Lewis may do so in his very succinct way, into the origins of the Sunni-Shiite conflict, which goes back to the days of early Islam. What I think even those of us who are not quote-unquote Orientalists, I know that's a terrible word, even those of us who do not deal with this professionally are aware that the Shias are a small minority in the larger Sunni Arab world, perhaps something like 15% altogether. And for a long time, they felt and were discriminated against, and perhaps, arguably, developed something of a persecution complex. But these days may increasingly be over, as there has been a noticeable rise in the influence, the weight, and importance of Shiite communities, notably in Lebanon. And we have seen, since the Iranian Revolution, a galvanization of a peculiar kind of Shiite radicalism with a messianic edge, something which particularly needs to preoccupy us in Israel, and it's one of the reasons why we have attached to the title of this evening's proceedings.
In the year 1948, when Israel came into being, it fought its war of independence. It fought its war of independence against the Arab Sunnites in the Middle East. The Arab states which surrounded it and the indigenous population here who were Sunnites. This was a united Sunnite world against Israel. And at the end of that war, nobody ever dreamt that there could be within the foreseeable future any possibility of a rapprochement, because immediately after the war, the Arab states made it clear that there was no intention on their part to proceed with the peace process with Israel, that they would have an armistice agreement with us, and that they would await for a better time to see whether they could do what they had failed to do in 1948. In the 50s, in the first years of the State of Israel, the Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, in his vision of what Israel might be able to do to improve its strategic position in the region, in the sea of enmity which surrounded it, created and fostered and promoted the idea of what he called the Alliance of the Periphery, an alliance between Israel and states which were not in the heartland of the Middle East from our point of view, but which could be natural allies of ours with common interests, partial or more than partial, depending on what their particular position would be, and that this alliance, this periphery alliance, could fashion into something more extensive, which would not only include defense affairs, but economics and the rest. And he reached out initially to two countries, one a Sunnite country, Turkey, but is still to some extent a secular Sunnite country, and he reached out to Iran. At the time, this was a very secret alliance. It was a secret alliance because the very fact that Arab states or Sunnite states or Shiite states would do anything together with Israel was very dangerous from their point of view and was fraught with jeopardy. And I recall that in 1956, 53 years ago, when I was president of the National Union of Israeli Students, I traveled to several international conferences representing Israel at the height of the Cold War, on the eve of the Sinai campaign and on the eve of the events in Poznan and the uprising in Budapest, and attended a conference among other places in a place called Ceylon at the time, now Sri Lanka, and tried to fly back to Israel through Bombay, where we had a consulate, but missed my plane, which was an Air France biweekly flight, and therefore was marooned in India without any possibility of continuing. And when I went to the Israeli consul there and asked what I could do, he said to me that since I was not a diplomat of the Israeli Foreign Service, he didn't think he had to tell me what to do, and I could decide on my own what I could do. So what I did was I looked at the possibilities of flights, and I saw Tehran on the map, and I thought to myself, since I knew there were weekly flights from Tehran to Tel Aviv, I would fly to Karachi, and from there take a plane, a Pakistani plane, to Tehran, and from there take a plane to Israel, not knowing that when I got into Karachi, the first thing that was done at the border was that my passport was confiscated, and I was more or less detained, and then put on a plane to Tehran, a small two-engined plane with 9 stops on the way. And when we reached Tehran, I was taken off the plane and put into a detention cell and told I should wait there until such time as the authorities there would decide what to do with me. This was a predicament that I did not expect. I had no previous experience in these affairs, and I waited for several hours until somebody approached the door of my cell and opened the door and walked in and sat across me, looked at me, gave me his hand, shook my hand, and said in Hebrew, Mashlomcha, how are you? To which I said, Mitsuyan, excellent. I didn't know whether to take him bona fide or not, since I had read a few spy novels in the past. And after a short conversation, it was obvious to me that I was talking to a genuine Israeli. And after 10 minutes, he said to me, do you have $50? And I said, sure, I have a $50 note. He said, give me a $50 note. That's what it will cost you. And he took the $50 note, and he went away, and he came back, and he brought back my passport to me, and he gave it to me, and he said, I've arranged for you to have a flight in a few hours' time, and you will fly from Tehran to Tel Aviv. And that was my first meeting with Yaakov Nimrodi, and it was also my first brush with the Mossad. The relationship between Israel and Iran flowered into something much more extensive, as I said, than simply a defense and an intelligence link. It became a very important element of Israel's economy. We not only bought oil from Iran, we constructed in the years to come a very, very significant pipeline from Eilat to Ashkelon, which, by the way, operates today, but in a different direction. It goes from Ashkelon to Eilat, for obvious reasons. And we supply oil to certain countries east of us, rather than being a recipient from oil which was then east of us. But nevertheless, we developed a very, very large relationship with Iran, which was a Shiite country, but I believe, at the danger of being called out by Bernard, I would say it was not it was more a secular Shiite rather than a religious Shiite regime of the Shah. And we also added to this two other countries. One was Ethiopia, which was a Christian country at the time, led by Emperor Haile Selassie. And we had a latent partner to this, a Sunnite partner, who for many years also maintained a big veil of secrecy over himself, and has afterwards came into the limelight, came out of the shadows, and that was Morocco. So suddenly we had this periphery which stretched from the Atlantic till the Persian Gulf, and it looked a very, very promising alliance. We thought it was a very good alliance. We could rely upon it for all intents and purposes. However, two things happened in the 70s, or three things happened in the 70s. The one was, as you probably know, that we had the Yom Kippur War, which was a war of various aspects to it. But amongst other things, the Yom Kippur War created probably the greatest divide we had with some of the non-aligned parts of the world. And it created a crisis, a very serious crisis, with some of our colleagues and members of the periphery. And had not we reached the point where Sadat decided, as Bernard said, to change course and to seek an accommodation with us, we would have been in very bad shape. But as you know, in 1977, the results of an effort which had been quite intensive in the years before that, there was the initiative, the Sadat visit to Jerusalem. We had the peace treaty with Egypt. We felt we were really riding high. We had a peace treaty on the one hand, and we had a periphery on the other hand, and then came Khomeini and the revolution. And that, of course, changed everything. It changed everything because not only did we lose Iran, but Iran became our implacable enemy. And as we looked further for various means of dealing with the issues in the region, we realized that after the initial breakthrough of Egypt, we would not have a similar event within the years to come, because Egypt immediately was ostracized in the Arab world. Actually, it was more or less ostracized in the Arab League for 10 years, if you remember. And we realized that if on the one hand we had just Egypt next to us and we didn't have the periphery on the other hand, where would we go in terms of the region? I'm not talking about the international aspect of it all. And we were lucky or unlucky, whichever the case may be, to have to contemplate what happened then in the 80s, which was the eight-year war between Iraq and Iran. And the basic problem was for us, with whom should we side? Should we side with the Sunnites or should we side with the Shiites? And in the Israel Defense Establishment, there was a very, very serious debate about this, whether we should be on the one side or on the other side. However, when we ultimately reached the final bottom line of this debate, we looked around, neither one side nor the other side wanted us at all. Neither the Shiites wanted us to help them, nor the Shiites wanted us to help them. So the debate, in effect, was a moribund debate. So we found ourselves, in the end, on the minus side, on the debit side of both sides in this conflict, and the only thing we could hope for was that the conflict would continue as long as possible, because we thought, and I think rightly so, that the longer the war continued between Iran and Iraq, it would be for our benefit in very other aspects, of which I would like to mention this evening, and which maybe Dori would like to mention afterwards. I would like to end by saying this. One of the things that I would like to conclude out of all this is, and I think that maybe some things that Dori will say will bear it out, in the end was that our attempt to engineer the Arab world, whatever configuration it is, in such a way that we would be able to use those divisions in a way which would permanently be to our benefit was, I think, beyond our capacity. We were able to do three things. One was to break the unity in the Arab world, to destroy Arab unity, to destroy the political impetus and the political value of the Arab League and what it represents. And in these days that we're talking this evening, you've seen this reached almost, I think, its ultimate conclusion, when a man like Amr Moussa says in the middle of the recent Gaza war that the Arab League is in a state of total turmoil and chaos, and I think it is. And I think this is probably an achievement, a strategic achievement. But that we could harness the Shiites and the Sunnites, and that we could sort of handle it in such a way and calibrate it in such a way that would be to our benefit, I think is slightly beyond our capability. It's even beyond the capability of the United States of America, which is also a power in the Middle East alongside Israel. So did I say something wrong? Oh. So in conclusion, this round of the first round, I'd like to say this. I think we had a good innings, if I can say that, in these issues. I think we did quite well as things went. And I think now maybe we have to see where we go from here.
I think that the Sunnite-Shiite divide is a very, very profound and deep divide. And I don't really believe that there is a possibility to reach a position or a situation where there will be a really genuine long-term Sunnite-Shiite alliance of sorts. There might be tactical understandings, there might be tactical agreements for mutual aid, but I do not think that, for instance, one can say, just to take one example, that the Hamas, the Sunnite Hamas in the Gaza Strip, are an Iranian satellite or Iranian pawn. This, I think, is a statement which makes it too easy for us. It's a very important, maybe, statement, Hasbara-wise, as you say. But if we look at it in depth, the divide between the Sunnites and the Shiites will not permit that ultimately a Sunnite entity will become really integrated into a Shiite scheme of things. And by the way, there are many leaders amongst the Hamas today who have made it clear in statements of the last couple of years that the alliance they have with Iran is an alliance which gives them support, money, weaponry, training, you name it. But they do not consider themselves a satellite of Iran, and there are deep divides between them and the Iranians. The same, by the way, goes to the Syrians, especially the Alawite minority, but also the Sunnite majority in Syria. They are not Iranian pawns. They are doing all this that they are doing out of a necessity that they believe is a strategic necessity of the moment. But ultimately, it is not possible to craft a lasting Sunnite-Shiite scheme of things. That's what I believe.